Class here, and coming near the end of our class on the law, however long it takes to get through this, I don't know, but we've been looking at how there's a moral law that's eternal, right? The Ten Commandments, we've seen that. We broke the Ten Commandments into two halves. One half is regarding God, and the other is regarding our neighbor. One we've called ceremonial, the other we've called civil, because the ceremonial deals with God, the civil deals with man. And then we've thought about these different laws with respect to an eternal moral principle. And as we've come now to these specific laws in like Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and even other places, we've only looked at just a couple of them, but they've taken a lot of our time. We've tried to identify whether or not those laws are ceremonial, civil, or both, and how that isn't going to be lasting in those states for what they are today. However, there are moral principles that are behind these laws that will last. And so you can carry those moral principles into any culture at any time. But that doesn't mean they're going to look exactly the same as they did in the Old Testament Israel. So I thought I would give us some others to think about. And some of these are more well known. Some of them are talked about in the New Testament. Others aren't. First one I want us to look at is the law of circumcision. This was a big deal in the Old Testament, right? And the New Testament, the book of Acts. So go to Genesis 17:12. And this is what it says. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money, from any foreigner who is not your offspring. Both he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. Now, look at what it says. So shall my covenant be in your flesh, an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be cut off from among his people. He has broken my covenant. And there's a wordplay at the end there, circumcision and being cut off. Okay? So the first thing to notice about circumcision is that it is a sign of the covenant. Now, which covenant are we dealing with here? It's a very easy answer. Abraham. Okay? So Noah wasn't given this sign. Adam wasn't given this sign. This is a sign for the Abrahamic covenant. What does this sign symbolize? Probably more than one answer to this. Okay, God's people. Anything else? Yeah, faith.
Circumcised heart.
Right, that will become important here in a bit. Anything else? Okay, go to
separation.
Yeah, we're cut off from the rest of the people. We're unlike the other people. It's a sign that I belong to God. You know. Let's look at Leviticus 12:3 now for a moment. Now we'll just read the context here, the first couple of verses. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel. If a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days. At the time of her menstruation, she shall be unclean. We've seen that with Mary, remember? In Luke? That she went and she gave the turtle doves, which comes just a couple of verses after this. Because she was unclean ritually. It didn't mean she sinned. It means she was unclean ritually and she had to be purified. Then the law, verse 3, on the 8th day of the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. So now this is going into Leviticus, and it's being codified in the national law of the nation of Israel for all the firstborn. So it started with Abraham, It's still the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. And now it's going into Leviticus. So now I want to ask the question, if you were to put this in terms of civil or ceremonial, or both, what would you put it as?
Both.
Both? Why do you say both? Yeah, this is a national law for the nation, the people. This is for the people of Israel to be circumcised. So it's definitely civil. In the ceremony, it's a ceremony that you do. That ought to tell you right there, it's ceremonial because it's a ceremony. It's done on the eighth day. That's ritualistic language of temple. It's done in the temple. There is blood that comes out when you do it. That's all ceremonial stuff, isn't it? So you have a ceremonial civil law that is to be performed, it says, perpetually. It's an eternal sign for your people. Then all of a sudden you come to the New Testament, and especially to Acts 15, where all of a sudden the apostles have this, the very first Christian council, and it's over this topic. And what do they conclude about circumcision and the church? It's not required. Not required. Why?
Well, we're circumcised in our hearts and in our mind now. So it's moved from the physical to the spiritual.
That's exactly my answer. It's moved from the spiritual, from the physical to the spiritual. So the counterpart of circumcision in the Old Testament is circumcision. What? I thought it was baptism. No, it's circumcision. The circumcision of the heart. So let's read, just to show you this, go to the end of Romans 2. The very last couple of verses. For no, this is verse 28 and 29 of Romans 2. For no one is a Jew who is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical, but a Jew is one inwardly, and circumcision is a matter of the heart by the Spirit, not by the letter. His praise is not from man, but from God. There's another word play going on here between the word Jew and praise. Any idea what that would be? It's a Greek word for praise is essentially Judah. When Leah had Judah, she said, I praise God, he's given me another man, and she named him Judah. So when Paul's saying that his praise is not from man but from God, he's essentially saying his Judah-ness is not from man but from God. In other words, a true Jew, which he said earlier in verse 28, is not one who is circumcised only outwardly but also but inwardly. So now let us ask a question about, is there a moral, eternal principle behind circumcision? And if so, what is it?
Well, when God entered into the covenant that required circumcision, he said this is forever. And so you can't just eliminate circumcision because God said it's forever.
Okay, so is it eliminated or is it not eliminated? It's transformed. It has moved from one kind of circumcision to another. Right along with the lines of the prophecy that you find in Deuteronomy. God says, be stiff-necked no more, circumcise your heart. At the beginning of Deuteronomy. Middle of Deuteronomy, he says, you are a stiff-necked people, you can't circumcise your heart. End of Deuteronomy, he says, I will circumcise your heart. That's kind of the three main ways of looking at Deuteronomy. It's great. And it's all around this topic. So the eternal it's an eternal principle. What's the moral principle behind circumcision?
Well,
What do you think?
It's being separate, being holy.
Yes. Any other components to that?
I think you look at it as it's got to be a work of God. Ezekiel 36.
Uh-huh. Circumcise the heart there too. Sprinkle your heart.
People don't look at the five eye rules. We always get into legal. He says there's specifically five things. I will do this.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Believing that's involved. Like, and you will bear my cross.
Mm-hmm. Sort of thing. So she said that there's bloodletting, there's it's a ceremony. And let's think about at what moment was circumcision fulfilled in this way?
Christ on the cross.
How? Christ on the cross. How? What happened there? Kind of. I mean, if this was his second baptism, you can in some way call it his second circumcision as well. He was already physically circumcised, wasn't he, when he was 8 days old, according to law. So in one way, you could say that that was the fulfillment of it, because this was a perfect man being circumcised. Now, that had never happened before. But in terms of the sacrifice idea, if it is, there is some kind of sacrificial idea going on there, that's where the cross is so important. Because the cross removes the need for the physical sacrifice part of that. And it's through his death on the cross that he is cut off from the land of the living. That's why I said it's kind of a circumcision. Meredith Klein does this in his work on, he's a Presbyterian, he does it with baptism and circumcision. He talks about this with relation to the flood as well, that all the people of the flood were cut off from the land of the living. That there's a kind of a circumcision that's going on there. Yeah.
I think there's also an aspect where Paul is talking about circumcision being revoked when we don't keep the law. And so the fact that Christ does keep the law perfectly, that also applies to the moral component of circumcision. That's how it can actually be applied to us, to our hearts. So it's not just Christ's death that does it, but it's his perfect sinless life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. And that actually leads right back to his actual physical circumcision, because part of his perfect obedience was the fact that his parents did that for him when he was 8 days old.
What does, so that's 8 days, and Jesus rose,
yep,
on the eighth day.
He did.
What's the relationship?
Circumcision is, well, if it's symbolizing being cut off in this way, so cut off from the living, but you're becoming a new people, then it's, in some ways, it's symbolizing resurrection. You see? And so that's the eighth day part of this is really important, I think, that you brought that up. That's really good. Because there's no question that it's shooting right at the resurrection. And because Jesus is now alive, kind of like what Brian just said, his active and passive obedience for us can now be applied perfectly in the circumcision of our hearts. So resurrection is deeply tied to circumcision. You wouldn't really think it, but when you start connecting all the dots with what's going on around the ceremony, the words, the timing, then that shows you exactly what you're talking about.
Well, how does the eighth day thing fit with the actual circumcising of the baby? Does it mean the eighth day of its life,
yeah.
Does it mean that it happened on the first day?
I don't think so. I don't think so. No. Because you would have an overwhelming amount of work to be done on that one day. They would spread it out. It's the eighth day of his life. But nevertheless, it's still the eighth day, and that's what is the important symbol there.
about something the priest says?
Mm-hmm. And just like a doctor today.
If this is off topic, let me know. I'm trying to differentiate between propitiation and expiation. Propitiation, I think I got the sacrifice, you satisfactory to God. But I've always wondered what expiation means from God's standpoint. Propitiation, this sacrifice is satisfactory to satisfy my wrath. But I never understood the expiation card.
I'm curious what you're asking. What's looking at? What's going on in your head to bring that up?
Because I picture the cutting away of the foreskin and tossing it away as something that was not needed or worthless in the first place, and trying to tie what part of us is cut away and tossed away. And what is that to God?
So as you're talking about the two words, what comes to my mind, I could be wrong about this, Carl, because I haven't thought about this for a while, but propitiation is dealing with the wrath of God. God's wrath is taken away. Expiation, I think, deals more with the sin. And so if you wanted to use an analogy of the throwing away, it would be the throwing away of our sin, our sinfulness. And so that would be more the expiation part. I don't know where the propitiation part would be in the ritual, but that's how I would differentiate them. One is towards God, one is towards sin.
Yeah, and I'm seeing expiation in the ritual, not propitiation.
Yeah, yeah, yep. Anyone else? Yep.
There's another, and I'll try and speak loudly. Another fact that I learned about circumcision and why it's on the eighth day is it has to do with the vitamin K, I think.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah, that it, after 8 days, it's when the baby has the vitamin K that they need in their system for the blood clotting. And if it would have happened before then, blood might not have clotted, you might have lost the baby. So that's like a medical reason for the eighth day, but I just think that's an interesting fact.
It is interesting. I mean, I never know what to do with those kinds of things because, like, did God really think about that? I mean, maybe. He's God. So did Moses think about that? Aaron? Maybe. I don't know. The Egyptians, they circumcised. Did they know about it? Maybe. I don't know what those people knew.
Yeah.
So, but it is interesting. Yeah.
I'm a little lost. I always looked at circumcision as a, a thing that God's people did because God told them to do this. And so when you were circumcising a baby, that was bringing the child into God's kingdom in an official way and, that sort of thing. I am kind of lost when you talk about Jesus on the Christ. Or Jesus on the cross being how that has anything to do with circumcision.
Well, it has more to do with circumcision other than the cutoff thing. I'll talk about that, I guess, in a minute. But more in a general way, like it does all the law. His death satisfies my need to perfectly obey the law.
And allows us to go directly to God.
Yeah. The cut off, you get it's a word play with cut off is what's going on. Okay, that's all that is. The same way with the flood. I mean, Moses is using that language very deliberately because he's kind of highlighting something that's going to come next. It's just kind of a clever thing to do. But I'm not saying that Jesus' death is really a circumcision. But it is more like what Brian was saying. It's, because he died, he's able to fulfill his perfect obedience for me, allows God then to give me his righteousness and therefore circumcise my heart, whereas that wasn't possible before. in the same kind of a way. So the early church says that circumcision is no longer going to be required for Christians. So the question is circumcision completely done away with then? And our answer is no. It's been transformed in the circumcision of the heart. Now, why does the church do what they do with this? What's their answer? What were the Jews doing with circumcision? What were they teaching about it?
That's how they're saved.
Essentially, that's how they're saved. And so, you know, Peter says, why would you want to put a yoke on the Gentiles that the Jews themselves haven't been able to keep? Now, isn't it interesting in all that context that when Paul takes Timothy, he has him circumcised. This is the same man that even in the same letter blasts on these Jews for their view of circumcision. Essentially, what Paul's view of circumcision was, it's just kind of a matter indifferent now. If you want to do it, do it. If you don't, don't. If it causes somebody to stumble, I'll have Timothy be circumcised. But if you're a Pharisee and you believe that this is going to save you, then he gets very, very upset about that. I've wondered that myself. I've never looked into the history of why it's especially, I think, Protestants. But I don't know if Catholics do this to their kids or not. I don't know. But I know in our circles, this is what we've done for 100, 200 years. I don't know how far back it goes. Yeah. Documentary on American circumcision from the 1950s.
So there's a whole study from the 1950s and 1960s where they made that claim, and there seems to be new data that would suggest that that's potentially all kind of not what's credited.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's a fairly large debate about it now raging across the country.
It's the same reason that they crop certain dogs' ears.
Only you, Eric. Only you.
Well, it's not really stupid. If it's not legalistic, it's just blatantly stupid.
If it's a matter of indifference, then you can do it or not do it, can't you? If it's a matter of salvation, then you better not do it.
Well, if you're 18 years old, you don't have much say in
it. Yeah, you don't have much say in it. But you do when you're a parent. And if you've somehow joined some sort of a Jewish cult that says you have to do this to save your kid, then woe is you if you're doing that.
Well, in fact, it probably saved Caleb's life because his reaction to the circumcision notified us that something was wrong. And he ended up in ICU for days.
Yeah, that's right. Remember when that happened? Circumcision probably saved Caleb's life, and she's talking her grandson, just because it alerted the doctors that something was wrong that they wouldn't have known if he hadn't have had that procedure. I'm not recommending to do that for everybody just to find out if your kid has a problem, but it is interesting, isn't it? Let's go to another one. You guys want a couple more or not?
Just wasn't it very strong? Wasn't it Moses' wife who said, "You're going to die if we don't do this"?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was pretty influential covenant.
It was.
God's not going to kill Moses.
One more point about the connection between us and Israel. In fact, Calvin, in the quote I gave you, said, "The church of the Old Testament." Did you catch that? I love that when those guys do that because it's exactly right. We are the Israel of the New Testament. They're the church of the Old Testament. They're the same, but they're different. We are not a national entity as much as some people have tried to make Christian nations and Christian empires and stuff. We are a spiritual entity. And our circumcision is a spiritual circumcision. And it fits right along with the type, anti-type of both of those things. Okay, let's look at the Passover. I just want you to think about the Passover as one. So God gave this huge, long law in Exodus chapter 12. Do you remember the context for the Passover? This is right as God is getting ready to end the terrible judgments, right, on Egypt. And he says, you guys need to have this Passover because tomorrow I'm coming for the firstborn. And so he gives us an elaborate ritual. And then they do it that night. And then the angel of death passes over their house and doesn't take their life. And then from that time on out, they were supposed to celebrate the Passover at that time of year every year. Of course, Israel was fickle and they didn't do it very often at all. And remember, there was a time when Josiah found the law, and or it might have been Hezekiah, one of the two. And like, uh-oh, we haven't been doing this. And so they have this incredible, amazing Passover day that they hadn't celebrated in hundreds and hundreds of years. By the time the exiles return from Babylon, they're taking the law a lot more seriously. And so when Jesus comes into this, they're doing this Passover every year. Now, what is involved in the Passover? The physical Passover. What did they have to do?
Kill a lamb.
Okay, kill a lamb.
Smear the blood.
Smear the blood.
Wasn't it with an olive branch or whatever that required a specific type?
Something like that. Yep.
Yeah.
Hyssop.
Yep. All, leaven in your
all the leaven in the bread, right? Spotless lamb. All of this language, does it remind you of civil or ceremonial?
Ceremonial.
However, who's it for? The nation of Israel. So therefore, what is it? It's a civil holiday. Isn't that interesting? You find this time and time again with Israel, that things are not as clear-cut as ceremonial or civil. Is there a moral principle that's eternal that's behind the Passover? What do you think?
Christ's death and resurrection.
His need to be the final Passover lamb. His blood covering us, right?
Look into it in remembrance of God.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there something also in there, too, excluding the Egyptians on there, I guess, out of borders on that, but like if there were non-ethnic Jews within their ranks in there, that they could still participate in that?
Yeah, they could. The mixed multitude, Israel has always been a mixed multitude. I think they actually get that one right, kind of, in the Ten Commandments movie. I don't remember which character it is. Is it Joshua or somebody who falls in love with a Gentile woman, and so he goes and he puts the blood on her door without her knowing it? Remember that?
So, yeah, basically the Gentiles gets in and has been there too, right in front of their face.
Yep. What is the... Okay. You know, just like with circumcision, which we know that we're not supposed to carry that through the same way that they did in the Old Testament. What about the Passover? Should we be doing the Passover every year like they did? I'm seeing some head shakes. No. Why do you say no, Chris?
Because Christ was a sacrifice for us and he said it was finished.
Because he is the Passover lamb. Now, is there any kind of a New Testament component that is a carryover of the Passover?
The Lord's
Supper. The Lord's Supper. Isn't that interesting? This is one of the few that actually kind of has direct command from God that we're supposed to continue to carry it through. And what does the Lord's Supper show us?
Jesus is and was the Lamb, and it was initiated on Passover.
Exactly, on Passover. It's directly related to it. So it's really, the Lord's Supper is the Christian Passover. But instead of a sacrifice to appease God, it is a sacrifice that has already taken place by God. And so we do this in remembrance of, not in anticipation of. Okay? So there is a moral principle. We've looked at the fact that Christ is really the thing that he's the one that the whole thing points to. Worship is therefore, I think, an inherent in the Passover, an eternal moral principle. Just like probably all of the ceremonial law has that in it. Circumcision should have that too. I was going to bring up with circumcision, by the way, that circumcision, Paul has this long argument in Romans 4 that when was Abraham circumcised? Was it before or after he believed in God? It was after, because it's a sign of the faith that Abraham had before he was ever circumcised. So circumcision, it is also pointing to an eternal truth of the need for faith. And I think that Passover, Lord's Supper, does the same thing. This is why churches that I think are doing this biblically are going to fence the table one way or another. Now, there's disagreements on how strict should you be on how you fence the table. But this is a meal that's for God's people. It's not for everybody. In the same way that the table of showbread was given to who? Priests. Where? In the holy place. It wasn't for everybody. Now, David shows the little exception to that, right? When he goes in and he takes it because he's hungry. But David did that by faith. So there's another moral principle there of the Passover as well, that you need to have faith in Christ. How about these? Let's go to Leviticus 23. Yeah, go ahead. Right.
And divided the Lutherans way, way back to the Reformation. Is there any justification for morally acknowledging this is the blood and body versus this is in memory of the blood and body? I don't see a moral connection.
A moral connection?
Yeah. But it was bidding up and split over.
Yeah, well, even Luther was like, I can't go as far as Thomas Aquinas did on this. So he tried to monkey around with it and say that, Christ is in and around and through it and all this kind of stuff. Calvin is a little different view. My view is Calvin's view, actually, that it's the spiritual body is present somehow in it. And so it's not purely a remembrance, purely a memorial. There's something more going on. And I think he's right about that, because the Lord's Supper is the gospel. I try to tell you this to you often. My view, I was just having a conversation with somebody here during the break about why I tell people to believe in Christ when they don't believe. He goes, well, aren't you a Calvinist? I'm like, yeah, I'm a Calvinist. He goes, well, they can't believe. And I said, you're right, they can't. He goes, then what's the deal? And I said, because I believe that through the very proclamation and telling somebody to come to life, that God uses that and creates life. The same way he did with Lazarus. And so that's because it's the gospel. And Paul says the gospel is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. And I believe that the same thing is true with the Lord's Supper. It is the gospel. It's a gospel not preached, but given to you for you to take. And because it's the gospel, it is powerful, not to save, because it's not given for that purpose, but to sanctify. So it's more than just me remembering. I'm trying to remember what Jesus did for me. It's much more than that. And I think that is an eternal thing, an eternal principle. I will say that I believe that many Catholics believe that. I'm not convinced that Thomas Aquinas believed that when he said it, but I think he's using philosophy to try and get out of something that leads inevitably to that conclusion. So, you know, this is one of the things. I want to be as fair as I can to those guys. But it's the Mass is as troubling to me as I think it is to any of the Protestants.
The problem is with it being flesh and blood, pretty certain that Christ did not take and cut a piece of himself off and bleed into a cup like the Last Supper.
Yeah. I mean they're messing around philosophically with God and time. That's what they're doing. And what they're trying to say is, well, we're not re-sacrificing him, but Jesus is always on the cross because God's outside of time. And we're just sort of connecting to that. I think that's just bogus.
Well, they're turning themselves up all other things, backing themselves in the corners and all that stuff. Fat and fallacy of the Pope and all this.
Yeah. It is a total shipwreck.
Does the scripture say that he's at the right hand of the Father now?
You're speaking my language, bro. Yeah, you two both had hands up.
I just like to say that I always like to include 17 and 16 because it gives the reasons for in it the righteousness of God is revealed. Okay.
From faith to faith, right? Yeah. Quoting Habakkuk. Yeah, Rick, did you have your hand up there or not?
Well, I was going to tell you, I grew up in a Methodist church, Mike and Candy, Lazakaway, and it was a dark place without shocking you too much. You take the Lord's Supper, and the church was a scary place. And I think it had to do with them messing with God's ordinances without knowing God. Looking back, I'm just thinking this through. And the guy died of a brain tumor at 18. And everyone was trembling, and nobody had any answers. And here we are, taking the Lord's Supper, and the stained glass windows had Zwingli and Calvin and Wesley, and all these names, you and I know what they stand for now. And I think really God threw us in darkness to the uttermost, because it was scary to think about these things. And that shouldn't have been. It wasn't until I heard who God is and his holiness, which was not preached there, and that I'm personally sinful, and that I need repentance and faith in Christ, that the light of the gospel came to me later in life. So it does, the Lord's Supper, preaching the gospel, I thought about that. They were, you know, they'd have Jesus Christ Superstar, which is, if you know, it's the most blasphemous play ever made up. And they would do that. So we were in the middle. I'll tell you, if I seen discipline of darkness for shunning the holy God, I saw it growing up. And church was scary.
Leviticus 23. This is a chapter where we detail all of these feast days. So you have the Feast of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, the Feast of Booths. Feast days, the calendar for Israel. So first of all, let's kind of think about this again, civilly, ceremonially. Can you see any civil function to these feast days? And your answer should be, uh-huh. This is a calendar for Israel. They lived their life according to this calendar. Very, very important. And these things took place, generally speaking, in the spring and in the fall. So around harvest times, some of these are even harvest festivals. Celebration of all the things that's included with harvesting and food and planting and all that kind of stuff. So very, very important to the nation of Israel, civilly. How about ceremonially? What do you think? Can you think of any ceremonial components to the feast days of Israel?
Fasting.
Okay, fasting is certainly a ceremonial sort of a thing. Okay.
On the Day of Atonement, they were so simple and treated as a Sabbath.
Very good. Very good. Connecting the Sabbath there, which we've seen is in the first table of the law, which is ceremonial. Lots of Sabbath stuff going on in the feast days. Offerings taking place on these feast days. Very good. Yeah, they were called Sabbaths, and sometimes they weren't even on Saturday. They were first day Sabbaths, that we've talked about that before as well. Yep, so there's all kinds of ceremonial components to this. Isn't that interesting? Now, we have some friends that are Christians that rent this building on Saturday. And they're a Messianic group. Mostly Gentiles, and they believe that Christians are required to keep the feast days of Israel. Now, I'm not going to say whether you should or shouldn't. To me, in some ways, it's a lot like circumcision. But they are doing some things differently than what Israel did. They're not doing wave offerings. Would be a major thing. A lot of times these people will use these feast days to sort of mark off special calendar days that have already happened with Christ, if you're a Messianic. A lot of times they will use them to sort of point to Jesus fulfilling something in the future with a feast day, like a Day of Trumpets or something like that. He's coming soon in the future. So we're going to keep this as a feast day. So that they will import Messianic meaning into all the feast days. What do you guys think about the need for a Christian to keep the feast days of Israel? None of us that I know of, I know that none of us as this church do that. Should we? What do you think? Should we not? What do you think? And I think that Paul speaks directly to this very issue in a couple of places, in especially Romans 14, keeping all days, some consider every day alike and some consider some one day more important than another. Can it become something that is legalistic?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you betcha. As they say up north.
So what were they doing? Celebration?
Sure, it was a celebration.
Yeah, it was a celebration, wasn't it? I think that
most of them. Some of them were a day of almost lamentation, like the Day of Atonement. But
yeah, so I'm kind of looking at in the spirit of it. You know, they were gathering together and glad around the Lord. You know, their holidays weren't, you know, take a cruise, get on a plane, go out camping. They were kind of around God, and they were really happy about it. And that's the same thing that happened in the New Testament, is they're eating and drinking and studying the doctrines of the Word, you know. They were delighted to do that. They weren't drawn apart from everything. They were. That's what I think of when you're talking about these feast days. They were daily when the New Testament church started. We're going to have one today, in some essence.
Just to give you a couple things to think about from a New Testament perspective, from my perspective. I think that in some ways, the early church probably used the weekly Lord's Day as like a multiplier of feast days times for 52 times a year. Because we hear about them having feasts on these days. Why'd they do that? Where's that coming from? I think it's coming from the Old Testament idea of a feast. And they're doing it not in honor of something that's to come, but in honor of something very specific, which is that Jesus rose from the dead on this day. Like, we've been doing church for the most part exactly the same for almost 2,000 years, and there's reasons why that's the case. So, you know, to me, I think that that's something that you should be thinking about every time you come to the Lord's, to the church with the Lord's people on this day. And that's one of the reasons why we have Lord's Supper every week. One of the many reasons why we have it every week. It's a little feast for us. Sometimes I'll give that to you to think about. Think about this as the feast. Paul calls it the feast then to the Corinthians. We also have in our constitution that we would like to celebrate the Lord's Supper once every year in a very special way. And we're kind of probably as bad as Israel. We haven't done it every year, but we've done it more recently than we used to. And why would we do that? Well, it's to kind of commemorate the fact that Jesus did this one time a year for a very specific reason. And so we usually will have that on kind of the Maundy Thursday before Easter. So I don't see anything wrong with celebrating a feast day. I think in some ways these feast days that these guys are doing is really going back to the shadows instead of living in the light of what Christ has done. I guess if you really feel the need to do that, more power to you. But I don't think that that's the fullness of the maturity of Christ. Everything, all these feast days funnel through him as a person. So this is the same thing as circumcision and Passover that we've just talked about. He's the purpose for them. He's the focal point. The magnifying glass and laser beam focuses right on him. And that would be the moral, eternal principle behind the feast days, is who he is, what he's done for us. That would be the lasting thing. And so Christians do think about these things. They do commemorate it, but we do it in a different way in light of what he's already done for us. So again, I'm trying to get you to see that it's not as simple as just saying, well, there's no more circumcision anymore. Oh, there's no more Passover anymore. Oh, no more feast days anymore. It's more complicated than that. Because there's ceremonial, civil, and moral application to all these things. All right, any last thoughts from you guys? Yeah, go ahead, Dory.
There's a movement that's gaining in popularity, and it's in some Reformed churches, but it's otherwise, and I'm not going to be able to remember the name of it, but it's Theo something, which is where you go back and you do the law. You do it the way it was said.
Theonomy, probably. Theonomy, yeah. Yeah, it's been rearing its head off and on like every other decade for 40 years, I suppose. And we've had arguments with people in this room about what exactly is theonomy. Like, sometimes it's kind of hard to figure out. In one respect, every Christian's a theonomist, because we all believe that God has eternal moral principles that still apply today. And if it's God's law, then that would be theonomy. That's literally what it is. Because nomos means law and theos means God. So theonomy is God's law. But there's a difference between what I'm trying to get you guys to see here, which is see the specific national, ceremonial, and civil application that God gave to the nation of Israel. See the moral principle. How does the moral principle connect back to us without what I think theonomists end up doing, which is making a one-to-one correspondence between the civil and ceremonial from then, and usually not ceremonial, because they know that Jesus has fulfilled that. But especially the civil laws, carrying that over one-to-one today. But there's a broad spectrum of theonomy. Like, how many of them, if you said, well, you're trying to carry over every single law one-to-one, are they going to say, yeah, that's not what I'm doing? But other people are like, yeah, that is pretty much what you're doing. So I want you guys to be just thinking more about how does the moral application of any of these laws, not just the moral law, the Ten Commandments, any of these laws, how does that impact our life today? And I'm trying to give you the tools to be able to think through how can I figure out what that would look like. Okay, so we've looked at three of them today. I do this one more time, and I think that'll probably suffice. We'll move on to something else. All right, you are dismissed.